bail entanglement and coastal traffic.
Good morning, Chair Smith and Commissioners. I'm Michelle Culver, and with me is Heather Hall. We're with the Intergovernmental Ocean Policy Group within the FISH program in the agency. And before we get started, just wanted to note, you may know Heather as Heather Reed. She recently got married, and she is now Heather Hall. So. First of all, before we get started, we did send out a summary sheet. It's been posted online. We had a revised summary sheet that was also distributed to you, and it has replaced the one that's online. We would note that there is one error in the revised summary sheet, and I will get into this a little bit more in the presentation, but I would note in the first paragraph, the last sentence, we indicated that the West Coast-wide whale interactions increased from about 10 per year. It says to 45 that were confirmed in 2018. That number should be 37. And in the second paragraph, it's elaborated on further as being 37. So we are here this morning to give you a briefing on the whale entanglements in the coastal Dungeness crab fishery. An overview of our presentation, we plan to provide some background information and an overview of the Washington coastal Dungeness crab fishery. Some of you may be more familiar with that fishery than others, but we thought it'd be good to have a refresher. We'll go through the NOAA summary of large whale entanglements. We've summarized some information, pulled them from the NOAA reports, both the national report and the West Coast report. That was also distributed to you and is posted on the Commission's website. We'll also discuss the status of those whale populations that are encountered in Washington fisheries and the steps that we've taken to address the whale entanglements in the coastal crab fishery, and also have some proposed next steps that we'll share with you. Would appreciate any feedback you would like to provide. So first of all, just for context of the Washington coastal fisheries, what you see here is a pie chart of the ex-vessel revenue that the coastal non-tribal fisheries generate. And this is the average revenue from the 2013 to 2017 period. And just to note, the ex-vessel revenue is the amount of money that the fishermen or the harvester are paid by the initial buyer of that product. So this does not include any additional retail market or any markup that may occur after the initial buyer receives the product. You'll see that, and we've generated this pie chart and showed it to commissioners in the past, Dungeness crab has historically been and continues to be the highest producing from a revenue perspective fishery in our coastal fisheries at just over $41 million on the average for the last 5 years. Our top five fisheries then follow as the at-sea whiting fishery. That's a fishery that's managed through the Pacific Fishery Management Council. The fleet is primarily based in Seattle. We also have the albacore tuna fishery and the groundfish shoreside fishery, then followed by our pink shrimp trawl fishery. So with that, I'm going to hand this over to Heather to provide some background on the coastal Dungeness crab fishery.
Thanks, Michelle. So the coastal Dungeness crab fishery is a state-managed fishery, although it has management authority that extends from 3 miles out to 200 miles through the Magnuson-Stevens Act for all three of the West Coast states of Washington, Oregon, and California. The three states also manage the fishery as a coastwide fishery to some extent, in that we coordinate our management measures together through a tri-state agreement. It's a limited entry fishery. There are 223 licenses, and we have about 200 active participants each year. It's also limited by a maximum vessel length, with some ability for vessels to expand their length by 10 feet. That was as of their length on July 2006. Each vessel is assigned a pot limit of 300 or 500 pots. That was based on historical landings, and we enforce the pot limit with individual buoy tags on each pot. This graphic shows the state landings and the blue bars and the fishery value that Michelle was speaking about in the black line. And you can see over time, and particularly in about 2009, that X vessel value increased pretty dramatically with new markets we have for Chinese markets and overseas markets for Dungeness crab. The long-term average going back to 1950 is about 10 million pounds. The 2017-2018 season, you see here, was just above 12 million pounds for the state fishery, but was over 15 million pounds when you consider landings by tribal fishermen. And we required a logbook for our fishermen going back to 2006. The logbook gives us a good picture of the footprint of the Dungeness crab fishery. It typically operates from about 5 fathoms to 60 fathoms, sometimes extending out to 100 fathoms. So on the graphic there, what you can see are the real high density areas fished are the darker red, and the lighter red or pinkish is less fishing effort. I would note that what you see on the three little management areas, we refer to those as special management areas. They're areas that are closed to state fishermen. That's why there's no fishing effort in there, or when there is fishing effort in there, it's because the special management area has opened later in the season to state fishermen. So those are areas that we've negotiated through our tribal harvest management plans with our coastal co-managers. The season does run from December 1 to September 15th, although that December 1 opening date is contingent on meat quality testing that we do, and that's something we also coordinate with the states of Oregon and California. It's a pretty fast-paced fishery. The majority of the catch is caught relatively quickly in the nine-month season. So we see the majority of the catch in the first 2 months of the fishery. And then, as I mentioned on the X vessel value graphic slide before, there have been new live markets over the last several years that have really increased that value to our fishermen.
Okay. Thanks. And the only other thing I would mention here, just while we have the graphic up of the crab fishing effort and how that may have changed over time, and what you'll see, as Heather mentioned, the mandatory logbook has only been in place here in the last 5 years or so. But if you were to go back further historically in time and where the crab fishery has taken place, you would, my guess is you would see this type of intense fishing effort that you see along the coast just south of that first UNA right outside of Grace Harbor, extending further up the coast. And that has changed as a result of the Rafiti decision which occurred in the late 90s, and we have been implementing with sharing with those coastal treaty tribes in those areas. So a lot of that effort that used to occur up north in those shaded boxes has shifted down south of Grays Harbor, and you'll see that's where the intense fishery is right now.
I don't want to get to something that you're going to get to, but I do have a question about this. Given that the most of the crab are caught early in the season, and looking at the season, is there any magic to that December? What I'm noticing is that the season kind of corresponds early on with the whale migrations north. Is there a reason that we start the season early in December? I mean, could we move the season to avoid the migration times and still allow the fishermen time to catch their crab?
Thank you for the question. And I will get into that a little bit more later, but the whales and the different whale species migrate at different times up off of our coast. By far, the majority of the whale entanglements that occur in this fishery occur in the summer months, so it peaks in the month of August, so not so much in the December time frame. I will also note that in recent years, when we've had the increase in whale entanglements, the fishery really has not opened on December 1 for some time, and it's either been delayed either due to domoic acid as well as in the north, the fishery is delayed as a result of our state tribal management agreements. So we've typically been opening in late December or early January. But I will also touch upon the crab regulations that Heather reviewed relative to the limitations on the vessel length, the pot limit, and having the individual buoy tags for enforcement, and having the majority of the crab catch taken in the first 2 months of the season. This is a highly competitive fishery, and it is very much driven by markets and high market demand, and certainly the demand for that is there in that December, January time frame.
Michelle, so we work with the other two states. Is part of that an allocation that's set state by state? Is that how it's managed?
Thank you, Chair Smith. Commissioner Thornburn, there is no allocation. There are no quotas. We manage the management structure is based on minimum size male harvest only, and during this season. So the opening in December is actually tied to the molt cycle. So it's when they've recovered from their molt period okay. That we open.
So. Right. Yeah. So then we would not close it when we hit a certain number of.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
So first of all, I will say that in preparing for this presentation, it was good for us as staff to become more familiar with the reports that are out there that have been produced by NOAA. They've had the whale stranding network in place for over 20 years with whale entanglements being reported during that time frame. And they've produced multiple reports. They typically do an annual report on large whale entanglements on a national scale. And then here more recently, they've added a West Coast specific report. One of the things that we've noted that is explained on their website under large whale entanglements is understanding the different terms that they use in those reports and the graphs that they display. And so it's really important to look at how the whale entanglements are being displayed or described in their reports as they use different terms. So the first term that you'll see is reports or confirmed reports. And those are citizens, either fishermen on the water, enforcement, boaters, calling the NOAA whale hotline and reporting that they have seen a whale and they believe it is entangled with fishing gear or something, or perhaps exhibiting some distress. So one of the things you'll see is simply the number of reports, the number of calls that come in, and in many cases those are include duplicate sightings or duplicate reports of the same animal as it continues to move while entangled. The other term is confirmed entanglements. And so NOAA also has different levels of responders, up to 4 levels, and they have staff and volunteers and agency staff that work for us as well that are trained in determining whether or not there is an entangled animal. And having one of those individuals actually see the animal, confirm that it is an entangled animal, is what results in the confirmed entanglements. You'll also see some geographic attribution in their reports. So you'll see them either at the West Coast level or sometimes attributed to a specific state. In some cases, they'll be attributed to Washington and Oregon combined, or simply just Washington. The geographic attribution is based on where the entanglement was reported or confirmed, but it's not necessarily where the entanglement occurred. So through their reports, if you notice that there are Washington entanglements being reported, those necessarily don't mean that those entanglements occurred off of Washington, but that is when it was first noted, reported, or confirmed by one of those trained observers. And then finally, sort of the peak, the highest level is if there's a fishery-specific confirmed entanglement. So in that case, that's where there was a NOAA-trained responder that went out, attempted to disentangle the animal, noted, took photos, noted the fishing gear, and was able to determine the specific fishery that gear was attributed to. As Heather mentioned, for our Dungeness crab fishery, all of our pots and buoys have tags on them. They're able to then determine that is a Washington crab fishery tagged buoy, for example, that's entangled on the whale. So in the NOAA National Report, this is all of the confirmed large whale entanglements by region that occurred in the last 10 years. And you'll see the West Coast in 2017, there were 29 entanglements that were live animals with 31 entanglements total. And how that has changed over time and how that compares with the other regions. Again, from the national report, these are a summary of the five most reported large whales that are entangled, 5 species. And if you look at this table 1 that's noted here, these are the confirmed entanglements in 2017. If you were to add up these numbers in the column that starts with humpback whale with number 49, if you were to add up the numbers in that column, they would total 76. And 76, then if you go over to the next table, so how to interpret what that means. These are the outcomes of those 76 confirmed entanglement cases, again, on a national scale. So, for example, the full or partially disentangled of the 21 animals that were full or partially disentangled, one was responded to, 20 had a response that was initiated. Of those, again, of those 76 that are broken out by species in Table 1, four of those animals were able to self-release themselves from the gear, and of those four, two had no response by, again, a NOAA-trained responder. Two had responses that were initiated. Specific to humpback whales, there are 14 distinct population segments. Humpback whales were listed under the Endangered Species Act in 1970. And of those 14 distinct population segments, there are four that occur in northern Pacific waters. And of those four, there are two that migrate off the West Coast. In October 2016, those two that migrate off the West Coast, there were changes in their status. The Mexico DPS, their population has increased, and so their status changed from endangered to threatened. These are the humpbacks that feed across a broad range from California to the Aleutian Islands. These are the humpbacks that occur off of Washington primarily in the summer, again, peaking in the month of August. The Central America DPS, its status changed as its population declined from threatened to endangered in October 2016. That population feeds almost exclusively off of California and Oregon. So I know this map is fairly small, but if you orient yourself to the U.S. West Coast, you'll see in number five, you'll see a yellow bubble, and then just below that, to the right, you'll see a pink bubble with six. Five is the Mexico DPS that ranges from Mexico and goes up to where you see those green bubbles that go along the eastern side of the Pacific Ocean up to the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. And then six is the Central America DPS that ranges from Central America up off of California and Oregon. So for whale entanglements in West Coast fisheries, so coming down from the national level to be West Coast specific, as we noted in our summary, we had about 10 on average confirmed per year in the 2000 to 2013 timeframe. That increased to 50 in 2015, 48 in 2016, 31 in 2017, and then about 37 in 2018. The latest report that we have from NOAA was produced, preliminary report was produced at the end of November in 2018, and that's where the 37 was noted. In their reports, NOAA attributes these increases off the West Coast to increasing whale populations, changes in fishing effort distribution, patterns of distribution and movement of whales, as well as increased public awareness of whales and whale entanglements. So they've seen an increase in the reported entanglements as a result of increased public awareness. The West Coast fisheries that experience whale entanglements include gill nets, primarily the drift gill net fishery that occurs off of Southern California, trap fisheries for sable fish, spot prawns, spiny lobster, and Dungeness crab. This is a graph, again, from the NOAA West Coast report that displays the confirmed whale entanglements on the West Coast by year since 2000 and what the species composition is of those entanglements. And as you'll see, the blue portion, light blue portion of the bars, which is the humpback whale, is what we have seen increases in here in recent years. So from that West Coast report, here is where those whale entanglements were confirmed. So again, where you see the stars of the confirmation, that is where there was a NOAA-trained responder that was able to get out on the water and confirmed that the entanglement had occurred, not necessarily where the entanglement happened. So in 2017, the West Coast total for all fisheries was 31, which is what was shown on that national graph. In 2018, again, the preliminary report through the end of November indicates that number is 37, again, all fisheries on the West Coast. Specific to the Washington coastal crab fishery, in 2017, there were two humpback whales and one gray whale. There were none noted in the tribal coastal crab fishery in 2017. In 2018, of those 37, the Washington coastal crab fishery had gear entangled on one humpback and three gray whales, and the tribal coastal crab fishery also had one humpback whale. So the management considerations are the presence and distribution of whales and how their distribution has shifted over time and primarily here in recent years. The primary prey for humpback whales are krill and anchovy. And krill is more readily available along the shelf break, which is at about 100 fathoms off the coast of Washington. So to go back to this, I don't know if there's a way to get a pointer or a mouse. But I can also just step up to the screen. Thank you. So the shelf break that you can see on the NOAA chart here is right here where the continental shelf slopes off into the deep water. And that occurs at about 100 fathoms offshore, which is just west of where our Dungeness crab fishery occurs, which extends out to about 60 fathoms offshore. So what we've noticed in recent years is that the whales have been feeding closer to shore. So smaller fisheries such as anchovy, there's been an increase in their population. They've been readily available in state waters along the coast as well as in our estuaries in the mouth of the Columbia River here in the last few years. So the theory is that they are now feeding closer to shore rather than further offshore where the krill are, which then puts them in the same geographic area as our crab fishery. Management considerations relative to our fisheries is that whale interactions are difficult to estimate and predict from year to year to try and produce an estimate of what may happen the following fishing year. There's also some consideration of gear regulations or the testing of different experimental gears that may not necessarily be feasible for all areas of the West Coast. And so, for example, the crab fishery that occurs off of California in the San Francisco Bay Area, they have some different gears that they're testing and considering putting into fishing regulations that may not necessarily work outside of those calmer waters in the Bay Area.
Deterrence. We've heard about that. Some deterrent kinds of things that have been used in other fisheries to dissuade other species is like sonar or something like that. A possible approach to this?
Yeah. So I'm not exactly sure to what extent specific deterrents have been explored. I will note here that we established a whale working group that's comprised of stakeholders,
yes,
and fishery managers, and they have held a couple of gear workshops that you'll see from this graphic here, that what they've noted is that when the rope, the line is slack in the water column, that is typically what results in the whale entanglement. Whereas if you're able to keep that line tight between the pot and the buoy that's on the surface, then the whales tend to not get entangled in that there's no excess line for them to get wrapped up in. I don't know, Heather, if you know of any specific deterrents for sonar or lights or anything.
No, thank you. I think, as Michelle mentioned, that's exactly what they're really digging into at some of these workshops that have been held West Coast wide with invitations to the three states. So it's something new. But Michelle does point out the biggest thing that they have seen, this slack excess line, and is actually an attractant. So by tightening that up, it's doing something while they look at other things like sonar and actually ways where we can know where our fishery is occurring and where the whales are, and some sort of a coordinated approach to fishing that avoids whales.
Thank you.
So so far what we have done is through the whale working group and these gear workshops that NOAA has hosted on the West Coast, we've had our fishery participants and fishery managers attend those workshops. As we noted, they've focused on the attractant of the slack rope that is in the water column, and NOAA scientists have done a forensic analysis of the gear that entangled whales that they were able to retrieve off of the whales. They've worked with the states to develop a best practices guide, which we distributed to the commissioners, and it is posted on our website. Which is a notice that was sent out to all industry members as reminding them about the need to keep that line tight and try to avoid having slack line in the water column as much as possible. There's also at the industries, they've developed these vessel placards that we have helped them distribute that go on every crab fishing vessel. That is a reminder of what they're supposed to do if they see an entangled whale. It's got the whale hotline on there, and it's got some reminders of the steps that they are supposed to follow. We have also, Director Susewin has also sent a letter to NOAA notifying them that we intend to apply for an incidental take permit under Section 10 of the Endangered Species Act specific to the coastal crab fishery and protected species interactions in that fishery.
Another quick question. So what is our risk at this point that we don't have or to the fishery that we don't have a take permit?
Yes, and that is a good question. So the fishery is currently not covered with an incidental take permit. We have had discussions with NOAA in the past. Typically, it's NOAA is usually the one that will inform us as the state fishery manager that we need to apply for a permit or that a fishery is not covered. The data that are included in our presentation and that were in the reports that we gave you are NOAA data. And so this gets back to the management considerations and the challenges and associated with the difficulty in trying to estimate and predict the whale entanglements that may occur in this fishery. So in short, we're unsure, but we do think that the prudent management response is to work with NOAA and work through the process of applying for and securing an incidental take permit for this fishery. So our proposed next steps are to work with NOAA to get a better understanding of the data and work with them to do an analysis to help us better understand what might be a good estimate for this fishery in the future. The NOAA Office of Protected Resources in Long Beach, California is the lead for this item. We will also coordinate with our co-managers. We did reach out to all of the coastal treaty tribes prior to sending the letter to let them know that this is what we were considering and solicit their feedback. The Quinault, Quileute, and Macaw tribes all engage in the coastal Dungeness crab fishery to some extent or another, and they are undergoing discussions within their respective tribes about whether or not they would potentially like to partner with us or have a broader incidental take permit that potentially covers the state and tribal fisheries. So those discussions are ongoing, have not yet been resolved. So we plan to continue that dialogue with them as we work through the NOAA ESA take permit process, and certainly we'll be sharing what we learn with them as well. We plan to have a couple of workshops this spring with our coastal crab industry, and we will also invite our co-managers to participate in those discussions. We want to discuss some potential actions that we may take, regulatory actions to avoid and reduce whale interactions. So we've distributed the best practices guide, which is lists out the best practices that they could voluntarily employ relative to the gear. We want to discuss whether or not it makes sense to have some fishery regulation changes. And those might include gear changes. It may include time and area closures. Again, as we've noted, the peak time frame of when humpback whales are migrating and encountered in this fishery off our coast is in the month of August. And we're also exploring electronic monitoring requirements, which is an effort that we initiated prior to this recent increase in whale entanglements to have some electronic monitoring capability relative to their logbooks, which are currently paper logbooks, being in electronic form, as well as the Quinault Indian Nation has an electronic monitoring system in place on their crab fleet, and they are able to, they have a chip that's embedded in every crab pot that when The electronic monitoring system is triggered by the hydraulics on the vessel to retrieve the crab gear. The chip is read in each individual crab pot, and that is an enforcement mechanism to ensure that the vessel that is pulling that crab gear, that pot actually belongs to that fisherman. So it has helped out tremendously relative to addressing crab pot theft issues in the Quinault fishery, and they've certainly been encouraging us to have that capability as well. Heather, I don't know if you want to also talk about the EcoTrust, kind of the what you just mentioned.
Thanks, Michelle. So as part of that electronic monitoring, we're in the exploratory phase where we're looking at different programs and that sort of a thing. And while we looked at the electronic monitoring for this management need, there's also some advancement in the electronic monitoring programs that are available that also are directly related to avoiding whale entanglements. EcoTrust Canada is does electronic monitoring for many fisheries, but some on the East Coast. And so they've had a lot of experience with the right whale issues there. And that now, that technology is now available to fisheries on the West Coast as we deal with electronic monitoring. So then also through this tri-state process, as you probably know, California is also dealing with this issue in a significant way. And we've talked about exploring this electronic monitoring approach through the three-state process, the tri-state process, and is there a way that we can all get on board with this and look at whale entanglements on the West Coast? So what we've just learned through EcoTrust is the new electronic monitoring. If you are out fishing, not only does it mark where you're fishing, if you see a whale, you can enter that in your electronic program, and it will alert fishermen all throughout the fleet that there's a whale in the area, and you can move, avoid the area, that sort of a thing. So we're pretty excited about that, although noting that we're just beginning to look at the concept.
So, and then finally, as the proposed next steps, as we have these workshops that are being held in the spring to develop, explore regulatory mechanisms, we would be developing and proposing those regulatory actions through the Fish and Wildlife Commission process. So we would be bringing those forward to you for consideration. And at this point, we are targeting the 2020 crab season as when we would have those regulations be effective. So again, happy to take any questions and certainly any specific feedback you would like to provide on our proposed next steps.
Thank you. Thanks, Barb. That was very informative. Yes, Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have a comment and then a question. So first of all, thanks very much for a very nice presentation, as usual. And thanks to Commissioner Baker for bringing this forward. It's good to see that you're one step ahead of the game, so to speak, in thinking about this ESA incidental take permit situation. Here we have a $40 to $50 million fishery out there, and there's been three or four entanglements for humpback whales. It would sure be a shame if there were some mechanism involved that would provide some risk to such a valuable fishery. So thank you for thinking ahead on that. And as you interact with those folks, maybe you could anticipate the future patterns of the whales and try to get as large a number as possible as to the allowable incidental take. We heard from the gentleman earlier this morning about the recruitment rate for elk in the Skagit Valley, and obviously the whales are doing a similar kind of thing. In addition, you mentioned the pattern of distribution. A couple of years ago, I happened to be fishing at Buoy 10 in the Buoy 10 fishery in August, and there were four humpback whales on the bar or inside the river feeding on anchovies. Never seen that before. And so it gets to the problem you'll have when you start talking about numbers. I believe there are some folks that will want that number to be as small as possible, But I'd urge you to think about 5 and 10 years down the line as to the recruitment and all of that to get as big a number as is reasonable. My question has to do with the proposed regulatory actions that might come back before the commission. And I wondered if, hypothetically, you might have a couple of examples in mind that could come from the workshops that we might hear about later.
Chair Smith, Commissioner McIsaac, one of the ideas is simply putting that slack line concept into regulation. So California tested it with a lot of participants in their industry and came up with specific criteria for how the length of your line and the number of buoys that you would have to keep that line afloat. We're looking at it similarly right now. As Michelle mentioned, it's in our best practices to reduce the amount of slack line, but a regulatory proposal would be to actually put that into rule. And that's tricky because it's going to be different depending on where you fish, the time of year you fish, you know, if you're in shallow or you're in deep. So that's the kind of regulatory thing we're exploring or that could be implemented. It could also include area closures or that sort of a thing. But that's would be dependent on what we know about whale migration and where our fishery occurs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I saved my questions to the end, and so. Only 21. Can you go to slide 8, please? And that's the graph. I'm having a little trouble kind of seeing the difference between the Northeast and the West Coast. I mean, is the West Coast, are we seeing kind of this increase over time? You know, they both are blue. I can't tell the difference between the West Coast and the Atlantic.
Yes. So the West Coast is blue. The Northeast, I'll try not to hit Vice Chair with the laser. The West Coast is blue, and it is this line here.
Okay. Okay, yeah. So
the Northeast is purple, which is this line here.
Yeah, it's hard to see the difference. So, I mean, that was kind of my thought is that this has been an increasing problem on the West Coast, and it's been prevalent in the East Coast for a while. So, okay, that's the first.
Yes, so the West Coast from 07 through 2013 has been down at this level, and then here in 2014, and then the big spike in 2015 from where it's been coming down since.
Well, what are the entanglements? I'm sorry to interrupt, but the entanglements on the East Coast, are those crab as well, or lobster? Or
I'm not exactly sure the full extent of the different
types. I don't know
but
crab fishery on the East Coast, but
could be some swordfish longline.
Yeah, okay.
Lobster. So then slide 11, mentioned some of the potential reasons for why we're seeing the increase. One that's not on here that I've at least heard about was delays in fisheries caused by, you know, like we experienced here, kind of the meat content, and then but mainly in California, the presence of the acid that delays the fisheries. Is that another kind of contributing factor? Is that you know, that we're seeing delays in fisheries and that interferes, or that kind of we're right on top of some of the peak whale migrations now? Is that also another cause?
Yes, definitely. How the changing ocean conditions and changing environmental conditions have triggered increasing frequency and duration of domoic acid events along the West Coast certainly has hit the California crab fishery more often and for longer than it has our fisheries to the north, but we've also had annual domoic acid as well as low dissolved oxygen events, hypoxic events off the Washington coast triggered by these warmer water temperatures and changing conditions.
Right. Okay, good. So slide 13. So if you look at this slide, you know, 2018, 37 West Coast entanglements, and then four are attributable to, or I should say, four to the non-Indian crab fishery in Washington. What about, I'm just curious, what about in the other states, say Oregon and California, in terms of their, the number of entanglements attributed to their coastal crab fisheries?
Thank you. I don't have the exact numbers, but it's certainly been highest in California of the three states. And then in addition to the coastal crab fishery, California has the other entanglements occurring in the other fisheries that they have as well, which are noted on this slide, the drift gillnet fishery. Their sablefish pot fishery has whale entanglements, as well as they have pot fisheries for spot prawns, ridgeback prawns, spiny lobster, in addition to crab. And that is actually one notable difference. Both California and Washington submitted letters to NOAA indicating our intent to apply for the ESA take permit. The California's intention is to apply for a take permit that is much broader than their coastal crab fishery. That would cover those other fisheries, would also cover other protected species such as sea turtles, which there's quite a bit of entanglement, for example, in their drift gillnet fishery. Much broader take permit application in California as a result of those multiple fisheries and higher level of interactions and multiple protected species. Whereas ours is focused, as you noted here on this slide, on these few animals in the coastal crab fishery.
Okay, good. And then just two comments, and pardon me, Chair, and the rest of the commission, but I think as we go forward, and I understand Washington is, you know, we're kind of leading the charge here, which is good. But I would just ask that that the department be mindful of the fact that many of our Washington crab participants also fish in Oregon. They're dual permits. And so one thing, and this is something that, you know, I always work to strive for my in my other job, is to the extent possible, not having different regulations in different states. That's makes it very difficult from a business perspective, from a compliance perspective. So, and I imagine the same is going to be true with Oregon and California, too. You have dual permit under this tri-state agreement now. You know, hopefully you're already thinking that way, but it would not be good to have, and I know under our intentions would be good to be proactive, but what we don't want to have a situation is that we're not in line with Oregon and California. That's a challenge. And then one last comment I want to make in terms of the value of the fishery. My office, I overlook the net yard at Fisherman's Terminal, and it's quite amazing during December to see. And okay, so this is just Seattle. This isn't Westport. This isn't Ilwaco, but to see the crab pots that are lined up, the vessels that are prepping, the fact that you've got you're employing trucks to, you know, freight companies to bring in and truck in these pots. Just the economic activity that we see here, or the value just on the ex vessel value, is just a fraction. Of the economy and how important this is. And so I just want to make sure my other fellow commissioners appreciate that. Yeah. And you know, there's one access. Sometimes I walk home and I was kind of in the middle of the street because of all the crab pots. And this is in Seattle, right? This isn't Westport or, and then just one other thing too, I was telling Commissioner McIsaac, I was in my local seafood store, And the price of Dungeness crab, shelled Dungeness crab, it's a high-end store, but $41 a pound.
Wow.
So I went to the farm salmon and said farm steelhead instead. So, but thank you for indulging me. I just wanted to...
it's always our pleasure to indulge you.
Dave? Just a question. You know, we did see the slide from 2017 with coast-wide 76 entanglements and 6 mortalities. In 2018, off just the Washington coast, we had 1 humpback and 3 grays entangled. Were there any mortalities, or do these numbers represent mortality?
This is dead, Darren.
Yes, thank you. So I don't know... to what extent the 2018 numbers that there were mortalities specifically, they have not provided that report, but I do know that they relative to these responses that occur. So first of all, I want to make sure that you recognize that these are the national numbers, not the West
right.
Coast.
That's
specific
why I was
numbers.
Asking specific to Washington, there were 4 incidents, and I just wondered how many mortalities. 2018.
Yes. And I am not sure how many of those
resulted
in mortalities.
All right. That's thank you,
Commissioner Baker.
I'm sorry if I may. In 2017, the 31 were the total entanglements. Of those, 29 were live animals. 2 of those were animals that were dead and already washed ashore with gear entangled on them. I don't know... relative to the 2018 numbers, again, as that report has not been produced.
Well, I wanted to thank you both as well, and Ron Warren for bringing this to my attention. This is a really good briefing. Mm-hmm. So now I have a sort of a curiosity question. I think we've all seen all the hero videos on YouTube of people cutting whales out of some entanglement or the other. When NOAA does a response, I assume that these entanglements, they don't stop the whale usually. The whale's swimming around with gear all wrapped around them. Can you just tell me what happens? What do they do when they respond? Do they actually go try to get the lines off the whales? And is there something that we should be paying attention to there instead of preventing, but what's our response?
Yes, thank you. So NOAA has 4 levels of responders, and level 1 being just the average citizen who sees an entangled whale or sees a whale in distress and calls the hotline. And so that's considered to be a level 1 responder. The 2 higher levels are the 3 and 4 responders. Within WDFW, we have 2 level 3 responders. Those are Steve Jeffries and Diana Lamborn. There are 2 level 4 responders, which include John Kalambakides of Cascadia Research and folks that work with him. The So there are a couple of issues. First of all, is that the level three responders, the two that we have within the department as department staff, are able to assist the level four responders in attempting to disentangle the whale. They are not able to disentangle the whale on their own. They are also able to respond to the mortalities that are ashore and doing the necropsies and the reports on those animals. However, I believe there are a total of three level four responders in Washington that are all based in Puget Sound in the South Sound area. And so their ability to get out onto the coast quickly in a vessel to respond to an entangled whale that's being reported, it takes hours, if not the better part of 1 to 2 days. And our staff try to meet them in Westport. Typically, we have vessels that are ready and willing to leave from Westport to take them out to the whale in distress. But that is, I'll say, that is one of the issues that our department has also tried to address with NOAA, is to try and get level four responders available in Westport or available on the coast to be able to respond that much more quickly as these reports come in. So that is one of the issues that we are trying to address with NOAA as well.
So then I guess if it takes us a day or two to get out to a whale, would these buoy tags that you're talking about that talk about identifying a buoy with a vessel, do they also have GPS on them so we know where the whales are that are tangled up in them?
No. Commissioner Baker, the buoy tags are just a rubber tag that's on there. It helps us, I mean, we can identify the person that owns them. So one thing that might help, though, is that placard that each vessel now, we've recommended they have it on their boat. It asks them to identify the location of the whale. As Michelle mentioned, these whales aren't going to just stay there until someone comes and takes the buoys off. So the difficulty is in keeping track of that whale until we can get our responders out there. But we are asking our fishermen to help with that, at least keep their eye on that whale so that when we do get the responders out there, we know where the whale is.
So the responders that jumped in the water and cut the ropes or whatever? Yeah.
I'm one of the two four responders. We work from boats. We don't get in the water.
Oh, okay.
The techniques were developed on the East Coast at the Center for Coastal Studies in Providence, Massachusetts. They're based on whaling techniques where we attach a big heavy buoy to slow the whale down. Then once it's going slow enough, you can pull up closely. We have about 3-foot-long poles with hooked knives. On the gear, sometimes the whale's tail is out there in the other water, for example, so we might have to use a dive mask to go over the side of the boat to make cuts. We want to make sure we remove all of the entangling gear, not just the easy stuff at the surface, because if you cut the easy stuff at the surface, the whale may end up dying with the wraps that are straight tied around the body. One of the main things we do as well is document the gear using like GoPros on a long pole to see exactly how the whale is entangled up.
Well, Well, thank you, and thanks for what you do. Is there a video about this?
Yeah.
Could you send that to Tammy?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, then she.
I mean, we haven't done anything professional, but after each case, we do a summary.
Yeah, just to see how that is done. And I think Commissioner Holtzmiller would be a great candidate for you, too.
Great report, ladies. Good job.
Thank you.
Good job.
Very much. Yes.
So this trend graph that you showed on slide 8 again, it's only a couple of years, but it kind of appears that Alaska has started on this trend of increased entanglements and has had a pretty steep drop-off in the past couple of years. Do we know if they've undertaken anything in their fisheries that's been successful, or is it environmental, or it's too short a time to say there's a trend?
I'm not entirely sure. I can try to dive
question. We're looking at, have they done something that's been successful, I think.
I don't know this to be a fact, but I do know that the longline fisheries, black cod and halibut in Alaska, they've been really affected by predation by whales.
Sperm whales.
Yes. So, and there's an effort underway. Many fishers say, hey, this doesn't work. So another way to harvest halibut and black cod is through the use of particularly black cod. Is the use of pots. So so that may, I don't know if that's, but there has been a change in some of the gear. Reduction of longline gear in favor of pots.
The sperm whales pick the black cod right off. It's called flossing.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
I have just one comment.
Okay, then we've got to get moving.
Yeah, exactly. Just to take a little bit different position than my fellow commissioners at the far end of the table, I honor the fishery and how important it is economically, and heard the plea for, try to take that into account as we ask for or work with NOAA on the take permit. But ultimately, our first responsibility is conservation, and I hope that that's just kept in mind as we're looking at the take permit and how we work with NOAA on it.
Good way to end. Conservation. Thank you, ladies. Thank you. And I think if it pleases everybody, we'll just do a working break. I think